Hello, and welcome to Bridge Design and Engineering's inaugural podcast. In this podcast series, we will be talking to some of the biggest names in the bridge industry, learning about key projects they've undertaken in their careers, as well as their opinions on important issues like sustainability, maintenance, and much more. My name is Khalifa Bakamas, features editor at Bridge Design and Engineering magazine, and for this episode, I spoke with Joanna Bonnet, Vice President at Covey UK, at the company's Bristol office in the southwest of England. As a graduate of General Engineering at Cambridge University, we started the conversation by talking about what inspired her to study the subject at degree level, as well as her early work experiences.
I was lucky enough to get some work experience with Bureau Happold as a kind of GCSE student, I think. That was quite key in really opening my eyes to the real stuff you could do with maths that you learn at school, like trigonometry. That sort of spurred me on, I think. I think it was more about following what I was interested in rather than sort of what the end result might be at the beginning, and really being interested in the kind of engineering itself, and the challenge of solving problems, and then really then progressing on to really wanting to be involved in structures where engineering is the heart of it, which obviously led to bridges, really.
So you graduated in 99?
Yep.
And could you tell me more about your first job after university and sort of maybe how that shaped or what direction that sent you in?
So I started at Whitby Bird, now part of Ramboll, worked in their special projects division. So I had a variety of small projects, and the main project was really being thrown into being site liaison engineer for a building refurbishment in central London, the Royal College of Nursing. And that was certainly a baptism of fire, from a heavily theoretical background to being asked to make decisions on site as a young engineer. And I think I learned a lot. It was pretty stressful, but I think I learned a lot. But after a little while at Whitby Bird, I came to the conclusion that I really wanted to be in the heavier technical engineering-led projects. And so I looked around and decided that Flint & Neal was a really good fit. I had a contact from university who'd gone there. It was still a very small firm at the time, but I knew about it from a contact at university. And so I approached them. The other thing that really attracted me about Flint & Neal was that had really good staff retention. So they had a lot of very experienced sort of specialists that were able to, you know, guide and lead the younger engineers, which I felt at Whitby Bird, with its fast growth, was one of the challenges there.
What did you do at Flint & Neal?
So I started off, as many young engineers at the time started off at Flint & Neal, doing a lot of work on telecom structures, which is a really good introduction to a kind of complete engineering project. You start gathering data, do an analysis, come to a conclusion, write a report, potentially design strengthening. It's like a sort of mini project that might take only weeks or months. I then moved on to working on a number of bridges, mostly working with Ian Firth. So that was a really fantastic experience, given it was such a small firm and it's such a kind of flat structure. I was, you know, working directly for Ian, assisting, attending meetings, and doing the analysis, and getting involved in some really interesting projects. Perhaps the most high profile of which was the Bridge of Aspiration in Covent Garden, which remains, I think, my most photo-worthy project to date.
I saw there was a photo in the, on the wall, yeah.
Yeah. It's yes, it's a much used set of photographs, and that was really interesting because I was then thrown, you know, into a concept design process directly with the architect, which was Wilkinson Eyre, and you know, at the stage of scribbling stuff on bits of paper, and taking that right through to through to the design, working through the geometry with the architect, and thinking through the challenges of a very unusual shaped structure, and really thinking from first principles, which I think is where I'm really happiest in trying to strip it down to thinking from first principles.
What was the most challenging part of working on such an architecturally ambitious bridge? This is still quite early in your career, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, it was. I think it was really a very positive experience because the architects involved, you know, we're used to working with engineers and in a really collaborative way.
Okay.
I have had other experiences in my career where the architect wants the engineer just to do what they're asked and sort of keep them in a box, really.
Okay.
But this was really a collaborative process where everyone's in, you know, got an equal place in the design development. So it was pretty positive. The challenges were really around thinking how you fabricate such a strange shape that the warped, twisted beam shape underneath the floor of that bridge is a really strange shape.
Yeah.
And thinking through how you might fabricate that was probably the biggest challenge.
Okay. And had you worked so closely with a large architectural studio before then?
I'd had involvement with various architects. You know, most of the bridges I was working on with Ian were bridges with an architect. So I worked with Cesare Bernarski on a couple of projects.
Yeah.
So I was quite used to working with architects, but in that collaborative style, which doesn't always happen in buildings, I think, where the architect is generally fairly dominant and lead. So I really enjoy the bridge side where there's more of a balance.
Yeah. What was the name of the bridge that you worked on with Cesare?
So there was the Rothe Basin Bridge in Cardiff.
Okay.
And the Ile Seguin footbridge in Paris.
Okay.
And both were sort of interesting and challenging in their own way.
Are they both road bridges?
Rothe Basin is a road bridge, accessing a development part of a sort of regenerative scheme, I believe. And Ile Seguin is a footbridge. Ile Seguin was really one of the projects that allowed me to really start to see where my career might be headed in terms of being able to pull together the specialists that Flint and Neil had at the time and bring their input together and tie it all together. So I didn't end up really developing as a niche specialist myself, but really enjoy that being in the interface of helping that collaboration to happen between the specialists. So there were some very interesting dynamics on Ile Seguin because it was a kind of bent footbridge, suspension footbridge in plan, and so there were some interesting dynamic challenges to be had there, and so working with our dynamic specialist and sort of pulling together the different strings was something I really enjoyed.
So it was a suspension footbridge, okay.
Yeah.
Is it largely steel?
Yes. And I have to admit to not actually knowing whether it's been built or not.
Okay. I'd have was to check it with one in a design competition?
It was a design competition. I think it went on hold for a prolonged period, which is why I kind of lost track of what had happened to it.
Yeah.
Because it was tied in with the redevelopment scheme on the Inseguin, and the funding for that, I think, dried up at one point because a big sponsor pulled out. So.
Would you say that more designs that come out of design competitions end up being canned than those that aren't the result of a design competition? It's just in my short experience in this industry, there seem to be quite a number of designs that are successful and win a competition but do not end up being realised.
Yeah, I think it was a problem, particularly when design competitions really took off.
Yeah.
And there was a real issue with poorly conceived design competitions, right, which didn't properly pin down the brief, weren't realistic about budget or funding, and perhaps didn't have the right expertise in the judging panel. I know that Ian has been very involved in formulating improved design competition rules to make sure that design competitions are more realistic.
Mm.
And as a business, we are quite selective now in which competitions we enter, both in terms of how many entries are going to be made, the pre-selection arrangements, what the jury looks like in terms of whether they've got the right expertise to be realistic, and then whether funding's in place to go ahead.
Mm.
Because really, it could be a huge drain on the industry if we spend time and effort doing these design competitions and they don't go anywhere. So I think the situation has generally improved from that perspective.
Yeah, Ian did mention for the anniversary edition, Ian mentioned the design for the Poole Harbour crossing as being sort of a turning point, but the design for that bridge was never realised either, and it's a shame because the bridge that Poole does have has been fraught with problems. The design that was initially proposed was a very beautiful bridge.
Yeah, it was fantastic, and I think that was a real catapult for Flint and Neil at the time.
Okay.
Despite the fact that it didn't get built, it catalysed our design part of the business. Having been known quite a lot previously for being a sort of technical specialist and working on lots of existing structures, it really catalysed our profile in terms of design.
In 2009, Joanna took a career break to spend more time with her young family. She spoke to BD&E about what it was like re-entering the profession after 2 years away.
How did you feel after the break? Were you sort of refreshed and raring to go?
In some ways, I was raring to go, but I think inevitably taking a break knocks your confidence.
Yeah.
And there's this strange feeling that everything's the same, but everything's different.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, things were the same, familiar faces around the office, but some new faces. And then, software's changed a bit, moved on a bit. And in fact, one of the really positive changes, I think, really was the fact that in the meantime, Flint & Neil had been bought by Covey. And so we're now Flint & Neil, a Covey company. So the IT systems had been upgraded to suit, connection to the wider Covey network.
Okay.
And that really enabled me to work in a more flexible way than had been possible before. And so that helped me to manage the juggle of two small children and a challenging job.
Yeah.
And worked really a bit more flexibly and gradually ramped up my kind of work commitment level in terms of hours from that point to now.
Okay. So it's 2010 by this point?
2011.
Okay.
I think I ended up back at Flint & Neal, and threw myself straight into project work. I think I soon, fairly quickly, started to gain my confidence back, and realised that my life experience, as well as my previous engineering experience, is all valid and useful.
Yeah.
And the sense of perspective I think you get from stepping away for a bit is actually quite useful.
Yeah. So by this point, I imagine that the profession itself had changed quite a lot since you first started. What sort of things can you identify as being different at that point to when your first initial graduate job, perhaps in terms of digital design and that kind of thing?
Yes, I think the rate of change in terms of digital design and power of analysis, really was taking off. My early days as, in ARUP, we had a shared computer between, a team of people where you book time on it.
Okay.
The email was on request that you could apply to have an email address. And it's amazing to think how things have changed from that point. And even from the early days of my career, already by the time I started, obviously everyone had a computer and we're all doing analysis routinely. But the real takeoff of routine finite element analysis rather than frame analysis took off, more heavily as my career progressed. But I think that perspective of having started from a point of fewer available analysis tools is actually quite useful, because you get used to being more selective, perhaps, in what you analyse, and a bit more critical of your analysis, and very clear about your analytical assumptions and boundary conditions, which can get harder to control the more complex your analysis is.
Okay.
So that ability to step back and critically appraise what you're going to analyse, I think is really important to retain.
Mm.
We might have the power to analyse the hell out of anything, but that's not necessarily the most helpful approach, and leads to the most clarity of understanding in terms of the structure you're dealing with.
Okay.
And I think as someone who bridged that sort of digital takeoff, I've very much accepted that I don't have the best digital skills around, but it is really important to harness the power of those digital skills. But in a way that still has a sort of clear eye on what we're looking to achieve.
Okay. How do you adapt as a professional to, I suppose there's a stepwise development, so you're able to sort of move slowly as the technology progresses, but are there any points or key times that stick out in your mind about where you've had to really try hard to make a sudden adaptation to new technology or anything like that?
I think in coming back into the profession after a couple of years away, I had to throw myself into to using the tools, and particularly finite element analysis, which is quite difficult as someone who's been in the industry a few years to ask the stupid questions of the graduate next door to you who's just started.
Uh-huh.
But that, you've got to do that sometimes to get familiar enough then to guide the process later.
Mm-hmm.
It's about developing enough understanding that you can guide the process even when you're not the person doing it, I suppose. And again, at the moment, it's about guiding the digital transformation that we are doing in Covey, it's about understanding enough that we know where we want to go with it and really allowing, enabling and empowering the people mm-hmm. who are specialists and who have their hands on the tools mm-hmm. To be able to have the freedom to develop and exploit what's possible mm-hmm. And not be holding them back because of your own lack of understanding. Okay. So we're very much pushing the agenda of giving our managers enough understanding that they can guide the process and enable exploitation of the technology. And that's very much the approach we're going with, that people should be empowered to push things forward.
Okay. So Covey has like a digital transformation blueprint or roadmap?
Yes, we're developing a roadmap, and then we've got particular priority areas that we're pushing forward on, and that's being done very much collaboratively, you know, across the business, across the world, where different parts of the business are pushing forward in different areas and then sharing that knowledge with everyone else.
What do you think will be sort of the greatest benefits that this transformation will yield in terms of sort of 5 years down the line?
I think there's clearly a really big benefit we need to gain in the carbon transition mm-hmm. And in embedding knowledge about our impacts. Right from the start of the design process.
Yeah.
So I think that's a key focus area for us, is how it fits into sustainability. I think the other key thing that the industry needs to be able to tackle is knowledge transfer into the future. Mm-hmm. I've been involved a lot in my more recent career since I rejoined the firm in existing structures and existing bridges. And it's quite shocking the poor level of information that exists about structures that even were built in the last 20 years.
Since re-entering the engineering profession in 2011, Joanna has led several high-profile bridge strengthening projects, with one of these being the Hammersmith Flyover in London.
So the first stage of it was in the run-up to the Olympics in 2012.
Okay.
In December, they found major problems with the post-tensioning system.
So it was December 2011.
11, yeah. And so very, very short notice, there needed to be a decision about whether the structure could remain open and how it could be open to full traffic ahead of the Olympic traffic in mid-2012.
Could you describe the Hammersmith Flyover for those perhaps international listeners that aren't familiar with it?
The Hammersmith Flyover is an urban viaduct in the west of London. It carries one of the main arterial roads into central London.
Yeah.
It's post-tension concrete, segmental construction, constructed in the 1960s, I believe, and it's had a history of concern about the state of the post-tensioning. It's effectively external post-tension inside the box,
okay. So
it's not fully bonded. There are areas where it goes inside the segments, but areas where it's external from the segments, and the legacy of some decisions made during construction meant that there was localised severe corrosion of the post-tensioning cables.
Okay.
Transport for London had a really significant challenge to be able to work out how they could procure the investigation, the assessment, the strengthening. And the construction of strengthening in such a short time scale. They engaged Amy to do both the design and the construction.
Okay.
And Amy approached us, where we'd worked very collaboratively with them recently on a challenging independent design check.
Okay.
And they approached, suggested us to carry out the design check.
Okay.
So I was the project lead for that design check. And because of the challenging program, we had a design review overlapping with the assessment check, overlapping with the design check, in order to enable that project to happen in such a short period of time.
Okay.
And so we were checking items, issuing interim certificates, you know, pretty much by the week in order to enable design and construction to progress and manage the risk going forward.
Okay.
And we successfully across the team managed to open the structure in time to carry the Olympic traffic into central London to access the, it's on the key route from Heathrow, where most of the delegates would be flying into and the athletes would be flying into, towards the east of London where the Olympics was held.
Yeah, it really is a key road. I've been on it many times, driving from Bournemouth to London, so yeah. And I remember when the works were happening and being rerouted, or I can't remember. Did traffic actually have close at
so
in that area?
Initially, there was a complete closure
while
the problem was examined, then reopened to light traffic only for one lane each way.
Oh, okay.
So a 7.5-ton limit, which is obviously hugely disruptive to such a key route. So then the strengthening had to progress in the space provided by that one lane of closure. Mm. But after the Olympics, it was realised that the problems on the structure were widespread. And although the emergency strengthening had dealt with the most immediate problems to enable the reopening, there needed to be a long-term solution for such a key structure. And we were engaged again as the checker for the long-term solution with a different designer.
So phase one, what did phase one involve exactly in terms of the strengthening works? What was done on the bridge?
So there was supplementary post-tensioning installed over the key areas where the post-tensioning had deteriorated most severely.
Yeah.
But that involved tendons above and below the deck, down the central reservation, effectively.
Did they use UHPC in that project?
Not in phase one.
That was phase two.
That was phase two. So we were then involved in phase two. And phase two, because the structure had reopened traffic with two lanes, there was a clear desire from TfL to not reclose any lanes. So all of that phase two strengthening had to be carried out below the deck.
Okay.
And that phase two strengthening had to completely render the original post-tensioning redundant, because there was no way to resolve the long-term durability issues with the original post-tensioning. And so the idea was to make it completely redundant by having a complete new system installed alongside the existing.
Okay.
And we worked very closely with the Ramboll PB joint venture design partners again throughout, because the unusual nature of the work meant that there were a lot of aspect not covered by the design standards. A lot of innovation, including the use of ultra-high performance reinforced concrete, fibre-reinforced concrete. So there was really close collaboration between the contractor, specialist contractors, the designer and the checker, because all parties needed to work together to get a solution to the very considerable challenges. And although it was a pretty all-consuming project again, and very challenging, I think it was, you know, a really key project in my development and career, really.
So, were Amy not involved in phase two?
No, yeah, there was a new procurement route because there was a little bit more time to develop. So it went via the framework that they had for the contractor and the designer.
So going back to phase one, how do you approach a project like that? We have a very shortened time frame in terms of organisation and communication. What are the most important bits to get right?
So I think the most important parts of that project were to look at where the risks were to the delivery of the project and make sure that we always had an eye on prioritising and sequencing our work to make sure we were addressing the key risks to the project, so that we, you know, that was our role, to manage risk for the client as checker and design reviewer.
Was the Hammersmith Flyover the first rehabilitation project that you'd been involved with?
I was involved in some packages on the QE2 bridge at Dartford, ahead of that, in terms of replacing expansion joints and that kind of thing. But it was the first major project I'd led in the rehabilitation area. I really felt like that was somewhere I'd like to kind of continue to develop my expertise. The sort of pulling together of those specialist areas and the particular challenges of existing bridges, you know, something I enjoyed. So I continued after that point to work primarily in that field.
Okay. What is it in particular that you enjoy about those kinds of projects?
So I think there's always a need to work closely with the client, because the client is an operating bridge owner typically, and the key is to keep that structure open and keep it in use. So there's always a close relationship with the client and understanding their challenges. And then there's often very considerable technical challenge because of the constraints that you have in working with an existing structure that's typically open to traffic. And so the sort of need to, again, strip things back to first principles and think around a problem is really key. So something I enjoy, and it often requires me to reach out, you know, across COVI and pull in expertise from across the business. And that's something, you know, that I really value about the culture, is, you know, you can reach out all over the place. And a number of my recent projects, I've, you know, been working with specialists across COVI internationally.
And in terms of climate change, the subject of rehabilitation and taking care of our aging bridge stock, I guess makes this even more pertinent to the future.
I've got challenges. Sort of a strong interest in sustainability personally, and you know, sort of in my own personal life, and I really see that working in that area is also really compatible with my own sort of approach, that we need to really make the best of what we've got, as well as building new, and everything we do should really be moving us forward towards a more sustainable way of working. It's simply not appropriate or economic to throw away the infrastructure we have already. So we really need to work out ways to make it work better for us and continue working into the future.
Yeah. And so was it at the same time that you were also co-leading studies into interventions for the Gay Valley Viaduct?
So that followed on after Hammersmith. That was probably the next really major project I was involved in, you know, various projects in between. But I got involved in the Gade Valley Viaduct, which started as a study of a potential fatigue problem. It's a steel composite structure that carries the M25, the main orbital motorway around London. It's a multi-span, 11-span structure. Typical span around 50 metres, carries four lanes of traffic each way, as well as some slip roads at each end. And
so hundreds of thousands of vehicles then?
Yes, I think the traffic counts around 190,000 vehicles a day. So, you know, really, it's about the busiest road in the country. So, obviously, with a fatigue concern around that structure, we had to work really hard to establish whether it was a real concern, and then how we could manage that both in the short term and the long term.
So what kinds of inspections were undertaken to figure out whether there were fatigue life shortfalls?
So first of all, it was looking at whether a standard codified approach would determine whether there was a fatigue shortfall. Mm-hmm. And then it was looking at a more detailed analysis, taking into account the as-built geometry of the structure, which, because of the very thin bottom flange plates, the weld distortion, the weld shrinkage had caused significant distortion of the panels. Okay. So although the codified fatigue checks passed, when you analyse the detail as it was in the as-built structure, you found that there were fatigue problems.
Okay.
And therefore, once the problems were clear and confirmed, we then moved into a process of management of that fatigue shortfall. So regular detailed inspections and non-destructive testing of the welds on the structure. And we had to look in detail at what inspection regime would be sufficient to ensure safety, obviously, of such a key asset. So looking at the inspection interval quantitatively using fracture mechanics, and then working through to fully establish the extent of the problem and then what the solution might be. And that's become a very significant project to install the strengthening for that project.
Mm-hmm.
And we went into a lot of detail with the analysis. We ended up doing a further stage of assessment using measured strain cycles converted to stress cycles on the project. So a very substantial strain gauging operation to use real stress cycles in the assessment, because the real fatigue demand was dependent on so many factors. By really refining it, we could reduce the extent of strengthening very substantially. And given it's a live structure, and it's at a considerable height above ground, the costs of installing strengthening are very substantial. So effectively, by spending about £1 million on monitoring, we were able to save several million pounds from the strengthening scheme.
Okay.
So again, using appropriate technology and to really refine the solution was really valuable there.
What's the clearance above ground for Gave Valley Viaduct?
I think it's about probably 12, 15 metres at most. So the access costs are very considerable to install the strengthening.
And what equipment did you use for monitoring?
So that was a conventional strain gauging program.
Yeah.
And we did first a trial in the most sensitive span, which is above the West Coast Main Line, which is the busiest mixed-use railway line in the country as well. So it's not only the busiest road, but the busiest railway line underneath. So avoiding strengthening in that span or minimising the extent of strengthening in that span is really key.
Okay.
Because obtaining possessions, extended possessions of the railway in that area can take years to plan.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, and even obtaining access for inspections is very challenging. So,
in terms of obtaining access for inspections, cumulatively, how much time did you have on that span?
So we typically had only a few hours in at night in order to do inspections. So we worked very hard with the non-destructive testing contractor to maximise the use of access from inside for inspection. I think we've probably used the complete catalogue of non-destructive testing on Gade Valley in total. We've had radiography, we've used phased array, ultrasonic testing, we've used eddy current testing, obviously magnetic particle inspection and visual inspection. We've used a huge variety of techniques in order to minimise the need to go outside and to minimise the need for any emergency closures when things are discovered during the installation of strengthening that are not as expected.
Okay. And so how long did that program of non-destructive testing and inspection last?
So the inspections at the fatigue sensitive details have been going on every 3 months to manage that risk. Since the original diagnosis of the defects. So that's been an ongoing, and then there's been targeted inspection of the other details or concerns as they've arisen. So I think that project started in 2014, and it's still ongoing. The major strengthening of the bottom flange, which was a really critical detail, is complete. But there are a number of other issues with the structure which are still ongoing. And I think it's really good when you can build up a relationship with a client and become their trusted advisor and work with them through the problems that might arise to manage their risk and keep the structure open.
So the problem with the flange was that it's only 8 millimeters thick, so vulnerable to cracks. What other oversights were there during the construction of the bridge that have led to these issues?
So the original construction of that project was challenged in a number of ways. It was the final link in the M25 orbital route.
Right.
So there was enormous pressure on completing the structure. It was very competitively bid, I believe, and therefore there was a very considerable move to refine the design as far as possible.
Okay.
There were a number of modifications made to the design during fabrication, and then further modifications made when the structure was constructed. And so there are a large number of details that differ from the fabrication drawings on site, which is one challenge in assessing the structure. The other challenge is that unintended consequence of very thin, large panels in the flanges, which leads to distortion, which then can be... leads to a mobile movement of the panels under cyclic loading.
Okay.
So often fatigue problems in bridges originate from where you've got direct wheel loads because you have lots of cycles.
Yeah.
So typically in the deck structure. In this case, it was about cycles from global loading, effectively pulling the panels flat, pulling the distorted panels flat. Okay. So it was quite an unusual phenomenon. And so it wasn't appreciated that might be an issue at the time of construction. But it was noted right from early in the life of the structure that it was unusually mobile.
Okay.
So the history of the structure has contributed to the challenges that we now face with it. But I think understanding of fatigue, you know, has come on a long way. Mm-hmm. Particularly understanding how to manage fatigue in existing structures when it's found. So we worked a lot to develop part of the remediation technique, which was plasma dressing of the weld.
Okay.
So a way of remelting the toe and removing past fatigue damage, which required a very considerable series of trials and testing to develop the approach in order to incorporate that in the final solution.
So what does plasma dressing involve? I'm not familiar with it.
It's similar to welding, okay, but without laying down any new material. So it involves really remelting, reprofiling the toe of the weld. So it's most effective on where you've got fatigue problems that would occur at the toe of the weld.
Okay.
And you can effectively wipe out the damage that's been done in the past and to a certain extent reset the clock on the fatigue damage.
Okay.
And in areas where we weren't able to establish that there was sufficient residual life in the welds after installing the plate strengthening, the plasma dressing was another component of the design to remediate that problem.
Okay. So in terms of strengthening, the program of strengthening is finished, but the monitoring is continuing.
So the first phase of strengthening is complete.
Okay.
For the original issue in the bottom flange, but there's a subsequent phase of strengthening that's ongoing at the moment.
Okay. Does that include the plasma dressing, or what does that involve?
That's to resolve an additional fatigue issue with a distortion of the cross frames.
Okay. And was that discovered sort of later on in your program of assessment?
It was discovered during inspections for the bottom flange issue.
Okay.
There were issues discovered with the cross frames.
Okay.
And so there was a subsequent program to assess that issue and come up with a solution for that issue.
Is there a scheduled completion date or?
I'd have to check the latest program because obviously COVID has disrupted things.
Yeah.
Although given the critical nature of that structure and that program, site has continued with suitable precautions in place through the pandemic. So I believe it's late next year that the program should be complete.
Okay.
I've had a change of role since that program, that project started, so I'm not involved day to day anymore. But I continue to keep in touch from a distance, considering it was known in my household as the bridge baby for a while. Because it kept me up at night rather a lot. During the early program of inspections and strengthening work, some of the activities had to be done during a closure at night, and I spent a lot of nights on call, either directly on call to site or as backup to the rest of my team who were based on site. And so, it's relatively unusual as an engineer to be on call, but it feel a bit like that. I came to dread the ringtone of my mobile phone for a while.
So was that while you were living here?
Yes, unfortunately, I used to live very close to the structure.
Okay.
But by the time work started in earnest on site, I'd moved west to the west of England. So most of the work I've done has been on call from here. I've had occasions where I've had to set off and head over there and stay
over.
Drive
over in the middle of the night?
I've driven over early in the morning
okay.
on one or two occasions in order to go and deal with something.
Okay. Okay, I can see where the moniker Bridge Baby has come from there.
Yes, one year my kids made me a birthday cake in the shape of the Gade Valley Viaduct. It had been so much part of our lives.
Useful. Well, it won the NCE 100 Innovative Operator Award.
Yes, that's right. Okay. Yeah. So that was positive in trying to summarise the innovative aspects of that project in a short presentation. So sort of refining it down to a short presentation suitable for a general audience was a good challenge when it's very heavily technical by nature.
Yeah. So would you say the most innovative aspects of the works were things like the plasma well dressing?
So there were sort of a wide range of innovations really in terms of the monitoring and fatigue assessment directly from monitoring data is outside the codified arrangements and pretty innovative to my knowledge. The plasma dressing was another innovation. We used laser scanning to do the initial assessment of the shape of the distorted plates, which is not often used to do an assessment of real as-built geometry.
Okay.
So there were a number of areas where the project really demanded a new approach and and a new way of applying perhaps existing technology.
Thank you so much for tuning into the first Bridge Design and Engineering podcast. I'd like to thank Joanna Bonnet and Covey for allowing us to conduct this interview. If you'd like to learn more about Joanna's journey in the world of bridge engineering, including her role on the Erskine Bridge in Scotland, check out issue 101 of Bridge Design and Engineering. The digital version of the magazine can be found at bridgeweb.com/issue. You can also find us on Twitter at BDE Bridgeweb and LinkedIn under Bridge Design and Engineering Magazine. See you next time.